Studio direction was by Jonathan Brown and the editor was Molly Watson. Time now for Plants, From Roots to Riches. Professor Cathy Willis, the Director of Science at the Royal Botanic Gardens in Kew, takes up her story of our changing relationship with the plant kingdom.
In 2010 was declared the International Year of Biodiversity. In this year, a study was undertaken in which UK citizens were asked to define the word biodiversity. The results were rather surprising, not least that the most common answer was that biodiversity was some kind of washing powder. Clearly, this isn't the correct definition. In fact, biodiversity is the term used to describe all aspects of biological diversity, from genes through to populations, communities, and whole ecosystems. But given the global challenges that we face in terms of climate change, a growing population, urbanisation, food and fuel security, it's perhaps understandable that many of us don't appreciate the term biodiversity. And even if we do, we then question whether biodiversity is a luxury we can no longer afford. It's the so what question. Why should we conserve biodiversity? Perhaps the answer lies in properly assessing how biodiversity serves our livelihoods and well-being. It's an approach that's starting to move up the political agenda globally. Take, for example, the United Nations Global Outlook Report in 2008.
Biodiversity plays fundamental roles in maintaining and enhancing the well-being of the world's more than 6.7 billion people, rich and poor, rural and urban alike.
So, in effect, it's an approach that suggests we value biodiversity according to its contribution to humankind, so-called ecosystem services. It's a radical departure from the protected area model for biodiversity conservation, where landscapes with the highest concentration of biodiversity are conserved. Just imagine a photo of a landscape with a patch of forest to one side, fields in the middle, trees around the field margins, and mountains in the background. In a traditional protected area categorisation, you would probably place your protected area fence around the forest on the basis that this almost certainly is the most species-rich part of the landscape. But if we're assessing the biodiversity of this landscape in terms of the services that it provides to livelihoods and well-being, the forest now represents an important regulating service for drawing down carbon dioxide. The trees around the edge of the field are important for nesting habitats for pollinators. The fields themselves are important for providing crops, and the mountains for recreation and mental well-being. So the landscape becomes partitioned in a very different way. It's a new approach to biodiversity conservation that was first highlighted in a landmark study called the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment in 2005, in which the so what question becomes two very different lines of inquiry. First, what aspects of biodiversity are the most important to conserve for the ecosystem services that they provide? And second, where are these located? As our series draws to a close, I'm going to be examining these questions and the research currently being undertaken to determine the true natural capital of plants. One of the biggest environmental risks facing humankind today is climate change. Much of this is being driven by increasing atmospheric carbon dioxide, which is now at 400 parts per million volume. Put into context, this is approximately a third higher than any other time in the past 800,000 years, the longest time that we've had good records of atmospheric carbon dioxide. Leaving aside the cause of this increase, we urgently need to find mechanisms to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And this is where plants come in. Trees are some of the most effective organisms at drawing down atmospheric carbon dioxide. Their essential role in regulating the atmosphere has been known for a long time. But which trees are best at doing this, and where? Two questions I put to Yavinda Marley, Professor of Terrestrial Ecosystems in the Environmental Change Institute at the University of Oxford. Yavinda runs a large global tree monitoring network for tropical sites across South America, Africa and Southeast Asia.
The tropical forests play a huge role because they are amongst the most productive ecosystems on Earth. So about 40 to 50% of the carbon that flows through the biosphere passes through the tropical biosphere, the rainforest biosphere. And also because they sit on the equator, that's where all the energy is. So that's where the forests affect the amount of water cycling back to the atmosphere, the energy balance of the Earth and the global climate. So they really are engines of global climate.
Which are the most important trees, would you say? I presume they're tropical trees that draw down CO2.
The ideal tree for drawing down CO2 is something that grows fast but then lives for a long time and locks in that carbon and holds it for centuries or millennia. And the tropics tend to have that combination. The other trees, such as the redwoods in California, are also important in that respect. But in the tropics, you know, one example would be something like a Brazil nut tree, which is well known across the Amazon, that's going to live for centuries. There are similar types of species across the Congo and others, things that stay on for centuries despite growing quite quickly.
Estimates suggest that between 2000 and 2007, the global forest carbon sink pulled down from the atmosphere a staggering 2.5 billion tonnes of carbon a year. Globally, the tropical forests pull down the most atmospheric carbon dioxide, followed by temperate forests and then boreal forests. Interestingly, however, tropical forests that are recovering from past deforestation and logging provide the largest sink, accounting for up to 1.7 billion tonnes of carbon drawdown a year.
They're the ones that can really accumulate carbon if they're left to persist for a long time. In the tropics, we tend to view landscapes that are deforested as somehow lost, as somehow they've lost their virginity or their pristineness. And actually, that's the wrong view. These are landscapes of incredible potential and resilience.
So that's quite surprising then. So you're saying that I'd always thought, you know, it's the mature forest there, the real carbon sink.
It shows the importance of also putting attention to second growth forests, things that are recovering. I wouldn't detract from the importance of the primary forests.
Absolutely, yeah.
That they have huge in value as carbon stores.
Yeah.
But often we can neglect what is almost a disparaging term, the secondary forest,
yes,
and actually
yes.
Forget that these have huge value in terms of the ecosystem services and the biodiversity they can host. And actually a significant part of our carbon sink can be in, the term I prefer now is second growth.
So all is not lost with your cleared tropical forest, as long as you leave it long enough to recover.
Certainly, and I think degraded can be an often misused term. It sometimes implies worthless.
Yes.
And actually these forests are full of huge potential.
But what about urban landscapes? Do trees, including those that provide street furniture in so many towns and city landscapes, make any difference whatsoever to the carbon budget? A recent study estimates that the carbon drawdown of street trees in US cities results in an annual carbon drawdown of approximately 25.6 million tonnes a year. Small but significant, especially to the city dwellers who sit under them with their lunchtime sandwich and breathe the air they help regulate. And how good is Kew at sucking carbon dioxide out of London's air? There are 14,000 trees here. How do they score? Even in this small corner of West London, the trees provide an estimated drawdown of 8.6 tonnes of carbon dioxide per year. Not bad. But new research is also suggesting that in addition to the regulation of global carbon budgets, trees could also be extremely important in regulating global water circulation.
If you have an area, say a deforested area and a cattle ranch in the Amazon without trees, when rain comes down, it enters the soil and then it ends up in the groundwater and out in the rivers and disappears to the ocean. When you have trees, you have something with deeper roots that can still tap into the moisture in the soil and pull it back up into the atmosphere and recycle that moisture. And it's been estimated that around half or three quarters of the rainfall that falls in the Amazon basin comes through this recycling of water through the trees. And that matters not only for rainfall, it matters for cloud formation. And the clouds directly affect climate by changing the reflectivity of the Earth's surface and reflecting more light back into the space, and that has a strong local cooling effect. And as the clouds form above the tropics, they release heat into the upper atmosphere, and that is one of the main engines of the global atmospheric circulation. So changes in forest cover and cloud cover in the Amazon can end up affecting rainfall in Europe and Central Asia through these large-scale connections.
Plants are clearly crucial for regulating water budgets and atmospheric carbon dioxide. This requires the management of plants, in this case forests, at a global scale. But at the other end of the spectrum, at the local scale, plants are also needed to manage environmental risks. Take bees and the risks associated with their decline. 30% of all flowering plants are pollinated by bees, yet throughout Europe and the US, there has been a dramatic reduction in bee numbers, resulting in decline in associated pollination services. Reasons for this decline are complex and as yet poorly understood. Several approaches are being tried. However, understanding plant chemistry and its influence on bee behaviour is providing intriguing insights which might well form part of the solution. And as Phil Stevenson, a chemical ecologist in Kew's Jodrell Laboratory, explains, it's all to do with coffee.
We did some tests with bees, and although we showed caffeine to be a feeding deterrent to bees, actually it occurs in the nectar below the bee's taste threshold. So it clearly isn't putting off the bees from feeding on the nectar.
So what's it doing there then?
We looked through the literature and found that there are some other interesting effects of caffeine, and one of them is actually on memory. We carried out some experiments that investigated the effect of caffeine on bee memory, and actually, sure enough, we found that at the concentrations that occurs in the nectar of coffee and citrus, it improves bee memory for flower odours. And this is very important because bees actually use floral cues like smells or colour or shape to remember reliable sources of food, and they use these to relocate food. So this obviously gives the plant an advantage, because if its pollinators are better able to remember cues from that species over others, they're more likely to return to it and then more likely to revisit and therefore carry pollen from one flower of that species to a conspecific.
Caffeine therefore appears to improve bee memory. So a flower that produces caffeine in its nectar will cause the bees to remember it better than other plants and will therefore be visited more often, leading to more frequent pollination. It's a fascinating insight into how some plants gain a competitive edge over other species. And understanding this link to caffeine also has an important applied aspect for training bees to pollinate the right crop.
In Kent, for example, farmers depend on bombus species, which they import from Europe, to supplement the pollination service of wild pollinators. The wild pollinators are in decline. They don't provide adequate pollination services, particularly early in the season. So one of the things we're considering is the possibility that we might be able to actually train these commercial bees to be more forage-focused on strawberries, so that when they're released, they don't start foraging on margin plants that are there for the wild pollinators and actually provide a much more effective delivery of that pollination service.
So what do you do with them, a sort of mixed aroma of coffee and strawberries?
Absolutely. When they are in transit, and potentially when they're on site, yes, they're provided with a small amount of food in the nest. But of course that food would have to be laced with caffeine to ensure that they're able to remember that flower odour. And if we can associate that with a blend of odours that resembles the strawberry or the raspberry, then perhaps when they go out foraging, they'll do that more effectively. So again, it's a case of understanding the chemistry behind the mechanisms that are influencing bees to be able to fully understand how we can implement them and how we can change our ecosystems.
So we can reduce pollination risk by persuading bees to wake up and smell the coffee. We can regulate atmospheric carbon dioxide by understanding which trees absorb it most efficiently and where. And we can even influence rainfall patterns in Europe and Asia by how we treat tropical rainforest. These examples represent just a tiny fraction of the natural capital of plants in regulating Earth's systems. But in evaluating biodiversity this way, it's important not to forget the other aspects of well-being that benefit from biodiversity, the sheer beauty of it and the aesthetic benefits it provides. In other words, it's cultural services. It's what we turn to next time.
Plants from Roots to Riches was presented by Kathy Willis. The reader was Clive Hayward. The series is produced by Adrian Washbourne. You can delve deeper into the plants featured in the series by searching for Plants from Roots to Riches online. This Sunday afternoon, Dan Saladino follows in the footsteps of a campaigning zealot.
In 1974, Derek Cooper, the founding presenter of the food programme, began a journey across Britain in search of its food. A search for BBC television to find out what remained of this island's regional ingredients and traditional recipes.
It's a bit sticky, isn't it? A bit fishy.
Well, it's a seaweed, you see.
Does it grow on you?
Yeah.
Yes.
40 years on, we'll be retracing Derek Cooper's footsteps. That's in the food programme here on BBC Radio 4 this Sunday at 12:30.